Side 14.
A hand was placed over his mouth. Reich opened his eyes. He was in a small, tiled room, an emergency police station. He was lying on a white table. Around him were grouped the guards, three uniformed police, unidentified strangers. All were writing carefully in report books, murmuring, shifting confusedly. The stranger removed his hand from Reich's mouth and bent over him. "It's all right," he said gently. "Easy. I'm a doctor."
"A peeper."
"What?"
"Are you a peeper?" "I need a peeper. I need somebody inside my head to prove I'm right. My God, I've got to know I'm right. I don't care about the price. I..."
"What's he want?" a policeman asked. "I don't know." He said, "A peeper?" The doctor turned back to Reich. "What do you mean by that? Just tell us. What's a peeper?"
"An esper. A mind reader." "Ah."
The doctor smiled.
"He's joking. Show of high spirits. Many patients do that. They simulate sang-froid after accidents. We call it gallows humor."
"Listen," Reich said desperately. "Let me up. I want to say something."
They helped him up.
"To the police," he said, "my name is Ben Reich. Ben Reich of Monarch. You know me. I want to confess. I want to confess to Lincoln Powell, the police prefect. Take me to Powell."
"Who's Powell? And what do you want to confess?"
"The de Courtney murder. I murdered Cray de Courtney last month. In Maria Beaumont's house.
Tell Powell.
I killed de Courtney."
The police looked at each other in surprise. One of them drifted to a corner and picked up an old-fashioned hand phone.
"Captain, got a character here. Calls himself Ben Reich of Monarch. Wants to confess to some prefect named Powell. Claims he killed a party named Cray de Courtney last month."
After a pause, the policeman called to Reich.
"How do you spell that?"
"De Courtney? Capital D apostrophe capital C O-U-R-T-N-E-Y.
The policeman spelt it out and waited. After another pause, he grunted and hung up.
"A nut," he said, and stowed his notebook in a pocket.
"Listen,"
Reich began.
"Is he all right?"
the policeman asked the doctor without looking at Reich.
"Just shaken a little. He's all right."
"Listen,"
Reich shouted. The policeman yanked him to his feet and propelled him towards the door of the station.
"All right, buddy, out. You gotta listen to me.
You listen to me, buddy. There ain't no Lincoln Powell in the service. There ain't no de Courtney killing in the books. And we ain't taking no schlock from your kind. Now out."
And he hurled Reich into the street. The pavement was strangely broken. Reich stumbled, then regained his balance and stood still, numb, lost. It was darker, eternally darker. A few streetlights were lit. The skyways were extinguished. The jumpers had disappeared. There were great gaps shorn in the skyline.
"I'm sick,"
Reich moaned.
"I'm sick. I need help."
He began to lurch down the broken street, with arms clutching his belly.
"Jumper!"
he yelled.
"Jumper! Isn't there anything in this godforsaken city? Where is everything? Jumper!"
There was nothing.
"I'm sick. Sick. Gotta get home. I'm sick."
Again he shouted,
"Isn't there anybody can hear me? I'm sick. I need help. Help! Help!"
There was nothing. He moaned again. Then he tittered, weakly, inanely. He sang in a broken voice,
8, sir. 5, sir. 1, sir. 10, sir, said the tenser. Tension, apprehension, ascension have begun.
He called out plaintively,
Where is everybody? Maria! Light! Maria! Stop this crazy sardine game!
He stumbled.
Come back! Rye called. For God's sake, come back! I'm all alone!
No answer. He was searching for 9 Park South, looking for the Beaumont mansion, the site of de Courtenay's death. And Maria Beaumont, shrill, decadent, reassuring. There was nothing. A bleak tundra, black sky, unfamiliar desolation. Nothing. Reich shouted once more, a hoarse, inarticulate yell of rage and fright. No answer, not even an echo.
For God's sake, he cried. Where is everything? Bring it all back. There's nothing but space.
Out of the enveloping desolation, a figure gathered and grew, familiar, ominous, gigantic. A figure of black shadows, looking, looming, silent. The man with no face. Reich watched it, paralyzed, transfixed. Then the figure spoke.
There is no space. There is nothing.
And there was a screaming in Reich's ears that was his voice, and a hammering pulse that was his heart. He was running down a yawning alien path, devoid of life, devoid of space, running before it was too late, too late, too late, running while there was still time, time, time. He ran headlong into a figure of black shadows, a figure without a face, a figure that said, There is no time, there is nothing. Reich backed away. He turned. He fell. He crawled feebly through eternal emptiness, shrieking,
Paul Duffy Quizzard Tate! Oh, Christ, where is everybody? Where is everything? For the love of God!
And he was face to face with the man with no face, who said, There is no God, there is nothing. And now there was no longer escape. There was only a negative infinity, and Reich and the man with no face. And fixed, frozen, helpless in that matrix, Reich at last raised his eyes and stared deep into the face of his deadly enemy, the man he could not escape, the terror of his nightmares, the destroyer of his existence. It was himself. De Courtenay. Both. 2 faces, blending into one. Ben de Courtenay, Cray Reich. De Courtenay Reich, D.R. He could make no sound. He could make no move. There was neither time, nor space, nor matter. There was nothing left but dying thought.
Father, son, you are me. We are us. Father and son.
Yes.
I can't understand. What's happened?
You lost the game, Ben.
The sardine game?
The cosmic game.
I won, I won. I owned every bit of the world.
And therefore, you lose. We lose.
Lose what?
Survival.
I don't understand. I can't understand.
My part of us understands, Ben. You would understand, too, if you hadn't driven me from you.
How did I drive you from me?
With every rotten, distorted corruption in you.
You say that? You, betrayer, who tried to kill me?
That was without passion, Ben. That was to destroy you before you could destroy us. That was for survival. It was to help you lose the world and win the game, Ben.
What game? What cosmic game?
The maze, the labyrinth, all the universe created as a puzzle for us to solve. The galaxies, the stars, the sun, the planets. The world as we knew it. We are the only reality. All the rest was make-believe. Dolls, puppets, stage settings, pretended passions. It was a make-believe reality for us to solve.
I conquered it. I owned it.
And you failed to solve it. We'll never know what the solution is, but it's not theft, terror, hatred, lust, murder, rapine. You failed, and it's all been abolished, disbanded.
But what's to become of us?
We are abolished too. I tried to warn you. I tried to stop you. But we failed the test.
But why? Why? Who are we? What are we?
Who knows? Did the seed know who or what it was when it failed to find fertile soil? Does it matter who or what we are? We failed. Our test is ended. We are ended.
No!
Perhaps if we had solved it, Ben, it might have remained real. But it ended. Reality has turned into might have been. And you have awakened at last to nothing.
We'll go back. We'll try again.
There is no going back. It is ended.
We'll find a way. There must be a way.
There is none. It is ended. It was ended. Now, demolition.
Chapter 17. They found the two men next morning, far up the island in the gardens overlooking the old Harlem Canal. Each had wandered all the night, through footway and skyway, unconscious of his surroundings. Yet both were drawn inevitably together, like two magnetized needles floating on a weed-choked pond. Powell was seated cross-legged on the wet turf, his face shriveled and lifeless, his respiration almost gone, his pulse faded. He was clutching Reich with an iron grip. Reich was curled into a tight fetal ball. They rushed Powell to his home on Hudson Ramp, where the entire Guild lab team alternately sweated over him and congratulated themselves on the first successful mass cathesis measure in the history of the Esper Guild. There was no hurry for Reich. In due course and with proper procedure, his inert body was transported to Kingston Hospital for demolition. There the matter rested for 7 days. On the 8th day, Powell arose, bathed, dressed, successfully defeated his nurses in single combat, and left the house. He made one stop, at Sucre AC, emerged with a large, mysterious parcel, and then proceeded to headquarters to make his personal report to Commissioner Crabb. On the way up, he poked his head into Beck's office. "Hi, Jax. Blessings and cursings, Link." "Curses? Bet 50 they'd keep you in bed till next Wednesday." "You lose. Did Moe's back us up on the de Courtney motive?" "Lock, stock, and barrel. Trial took 1 hour. Reich's going into demolition now." "Good.
Well, I'd better go up and S-P-E-L-L it out for crab. What you got under your arm? Present. For me? Not today. Here's thinking at you. Pal went up to Crab's ebony and silver office, knocked, heard the Imperius come, and entered. Crab was properly solicitous, but stiff. The de Courtney case had not improved his relations with Pal. The denouement had come as an additional blow.
It was a remarkably complex case, sir, Pal began tactfully. None of us could understand it, and none of us are to blame. You see, Commissioner, even Reich himself was not consciously aware of why he had murdered de Courtney. The only one who grasped the case was the prosecution computer, and we thought it was acting kittenish.
The machine? It understood?
Yes, sir. When we ran our final data through the first time, the computer told us that the passion motive was insufficiently documented. We'd all been assuming a profit motive. So had Reich. Naturally, we assumed the computer was having kinks, and we insisted on computation based on the profit motive. We were wrong.
And that infernal machine was right?
Yes, Commissioner, it was. Reich told me himself that he was killing de Courtney for financial reasons. That was his psychological camouflage for the real passion motive. And it couldn't hold up. He offered merger to de Courtney. De Courtney accepted. But Reich was subconsciously compelled to misunderstand the message. He had to. He had to go on believing he murdered for money.
Why?
Because he couldn't face the real motive.
Which was?
De Courtney was his father.
What?
Crab stared.
His father? His flesh and blood?
Yes, sir. It was all there before us. We just couldn't see it because Reich couldn't see it. That estate on Callisto, for instance, the one that Reich used to decoy Dr. Jordan off the planet, Reich inherited it from his mother, who'd received it from de Courtney. We all assumed Reich's father had chiseled it out of de Courtney and placed it in his wife's name. We were wrong. De Courtney had given it to Reich's mother because they were lovers. It was his love gift to the mother of his child. Reich was born there. Jackson Beck uncovered all that once we had the lead.
Crab opened his mouth and closed it.
And there were so many other signposts. De Courtney's suicide drive, produced by intense guilt sensations of abandonment. He had abandoned his son. It was tearing him apart. Then Barbara de Courtney's deep half-twin image of herself and Ben Reich. Somehow she knew they were half-brother and sister. And Reich's inability to kill Barbara Chukafroods. He knew it too, deep down in the unconscious. He wanted to destroy the hateful father who had rejected him, but he couldn't bring himself to harm his sister.
Yeah, but when did you unearth all this?
After the case was closed, sir, when Reich attacked me for setting those booby traps.
He claimed you did. But if you didn't, Pal, who did?
Reich himself, sir.
Reich?
Yes, sir. He murdered his father. He discharged his hatred. But his superego, his conscience, would not permit him to go unpunished for such a horrible crime. Since the police apparently were unable to punish him, his conscience took over. That was the meaning of Reich's nightmare image, the man with no face.
The man with no face?
Yes, Commissioner. It was the symbol of Reich's real relationship to de Courtney. The figure had no face because Reich could not accept the truth that he had recognized de Courtney as his father. The figure appeared in his dreams when he made the decision to kill his father. It never left him. It was first the threat of punishment for what he contemplated, then it became the punishment itself for the murder.
The booby traps?
Exactly. His conscience had to punish him.
but Reich had never admitted to himself that he murdered because he hated de Courtenay as a father who'd rejected and abandoned him. Therefore, the punishment had to take place on the unconscious level. Reich set those traps for himself, without ever realizing it, in his sleep. Somnambulistically, during the day in short fugues, brief departures from conscious reality. The tricks of the mind mechanism are fantastic.
But if Reich himself knew none of this, how did you get at it, Paul?
Well, sir, that was the problem. We couldn't get it by peeping him. He was hostile. And you have to have complete cooperation from a subject to get that kind of material. It takes months, anyway. Also, if Reich recovered from the series of shocks he'd had, he'd be able to readjust, reorient, and become immune to us. That was dangerous, too, because he was in a position of power to rock the solar system. He was one of those rare world shakers whose compulsions might have torn down our society and irrevocably committed us to his own psychotic pattern. Crabbe nodded. He very nearly succeeded. These men appear every so often, links between the past and the future. If they are permitted to mature, if the link is permitted to weld, the world finds itself chained to a dreadful tomorrow.
Then what did you do?
We used the mass cathesis measure, sir. It's difficult to explain, but I'll do my best. Every human being has a psyche composed of latent and capitalized energy. Latent energy is our reserve, the untapped natural resources of our mind. Capitalized energy is that latent energy which we call up and put to work. Most of us use only a small portion of our latent energy.
I understand.
When the Esper Guild uses the mass cathesis measure, every Esper opens his psyche, so to speak, and contributes his latent energy to a pool. One Esper alone taps this pool and becomes the canal for the latent energy. He capitalizes it and puts it to work. He can accomplish tremendous things if he can control it. It's a difficult and dangerous operation, about on a par with jetting to the moon with a stick of dynamite, riding on sticks of dynamite. Suddenly, Crabbe grinned.
I wish I were a peeper, he said. I'd like to get the real image in your mind.
You got it already, sir, Paul grinned back. A rapport had been established between them for the first time. It was necessary, Paul continued, to confront Reich with the man with no face. We had to make him see the truth before we could get the truth. Using the pool of latent energy, I built a common neurotic concept for Reich, the illusion that he alone in the world was real.
Why, Ivor, is that common?
Oh, yes, sir. It's one of the run-of-the-mill escape patterns. When life gets tough, you tend to take refuge in the idea that it's all make-believe, a giant hoax. Reich had the seeds of that weakness in him already. I simply forced them and let Reich defeat himself. Life was getting tough for him. I persuaded him to believe that the universe was a hoax, a puzzle box. Then I tore it down, layer by layer. I made him believe that the test was ended, the puzzle was being dismantled. And I left Reich alone with the man with no face. He looked into the face and saw himself and his father, and we had everything. Paul picked up his parcel and rose. Crabbe jumped up and escorted him to the door with a friendly hand on his shoulder.
You've done a phenomenal job, Paul, really phenomenal. I can't tell you. It must be a wonderful thing to be an Esper.
Wonderful and terrible, sir.
You must all be very happy.
Happy? Paul paused at the door and looked at Crabbe. Would you be happy to live your life in a hospital, Commissioner?
A hospital?
That's where we live, all of us. In the psychiatric ward. without escape, without refuge. Be grateful you're not a peeper, sir. Be grateful that you only see the outward man. Be grateful that you never see the passions, the hatreds, the jealousies, the malice, the sickness. Be grateful you rarely see the frightening truth in people. The world will be a wonderful place when everyone's a peeper and everyone's adjusted. But until then, be grateful you're not a peeper. He left headquarters, hired a jumper, and was jetted north towards Kingston Hospital. He sat in the cabin with the parcel on his knees, gazing down at the magnificent Hudson Valley, whistling a crooked tune. Once he grinned and muttered, "Wow, that was some line I handed Crab, but I had to cement our relations. Now you'll feel sorry for peepers, and friendly." Kingston Hospital came into view, acre upon rolling acre of magnificent landscaping. Solariums, pools, lawns, athletic fields, dormitories, clinics, all in exquisite neoclassic design. As the jumper descended, Powell could make out the figures of patients and attendants, all bronzed, active, laughing, playing. He thought of the vigilant measures the Board of Governors was forced to take to prevent Kingston Hospital from becoming another spaceland. Too many fashionable malingerers were already attempting to obtain admission. Powell checked in at the visitor's office, found Barbara de Courtenay's location, and started across the grounds. He was weak, but he wanted to leap hedges, vault gates, run races. He had awakened after 7 days' exhaustion with a question. One question to ask Barbara. He felt exhilarated. They saw each other at the same moment. Across a broad stretch of lawn, flanked by fieldstone terraces and brilliant gardens. She flew towards him waving, and he ran towards her. Then, as they approached, both were stricken with shyness. They stopped a few feet apart, not daring to look at each other.
Hello.
Hello, Barbara.
Let's get into the shade, shall we?
They turned towards the terrace wall. Powell glanced at her from the corner of his eye. She was alive again, as alive as he had ever seen her before. And her urchin expression, the expression that he had imagined was a phase of her déjà éprouvé development, was still there. She looked inexpressibly mischievous, high-spirited, fascinating. But she was adult. He did not know her.
"I'm being discharged this evening,"
Barbara said.
"I know." "I'm terribly grateful to you for all you've..."
"Please, don't say that."
"For all you've done,"
Barbara continued firmly. They sat down on a stone bench. She looked at him with grave eyes.
"I want to tell you how grateful I am."
"Please, Barbara, you're terrifying me."
"Am I?"
"I knew you so intimately as, well, as a child. Now
I'm grown up again."
"Yes.
You must get to know me better."
She smiled graciously.
"Shall we say tea tomorrow at 5?
"At 5?
"Informal. Don't dress."
"Listen," Powell said desperately. "I helped dress you more than once, and comb your hair and brush your teeth." She waved her hand airily. "Your table manners were a caution. You liked fish, but you hated lamb. You hit me in the eye with a chop."
"That was ages ago, Mr. Powell."
"That was 2 weeks ago, Mr. Courtenay." She arose with magnificent poise.
"Really, Mr. Powell, I feel it would be best to end the interview. If you feel impelled to cast chronographical aspersions..."
She stopped and looked at him. The urchin appeared again in her face.
"Chronographical?"
she inquired. He dropped the parcel and caught her in his arms.
"Mr. Powell, Mr. Powell, Mr. Powell," she murmured. "Hello, Mr. Powell."
My God, Barbara. Baba, dear, for a moment I thought you meant it. I was paying you back for being grown up. You always were a revengeful kid. You always were a mean daddy.
She leaned back and looked at him.
What are you really like? What are we both like? Will we have time to find out?
Time?
Before... Peep me, I can't say it.
No, dear, you'll have to say it.
Mary Noyes told me everything.
Oh, she did. Barbara nodded.
But I don't care. I don't care. She was right. I'll settle for anything, even if you can't marry me.
He laughed. The exhilaration bubbled out of him. You won't have to settle for anything, he said. Sit down. I want to ask you one question. She sat down on his lap. I have to go back to that night, he said.
In Beaumont House?
He nodded.
It's not easy to talk about.
It won't take a minute. Now you were lying in bed asleep. Suddenly you woke up and rushed into the orchid room. You remember the rest?
I remember.
One question. What was the cry that woke you?
You know.
I know, but I want you to say it. Say it out loud.
Do you think it's going to send me into hysteria again?
No. Just say it. After a long pause, you said in a low voice,
"Help, Barbara."
He nodded again. Who shouted that?
Why, it was...
Suddenly she stopped. It wasn't Ben Reich. He wouldn't be yelling for help. He didn't need help. Who did?
My father?
But he couldn't speak, Barbara. His throat was gone. Cancer. He couldn't utter a word.
I heard him.
You peeped him. She stared. Then she shook her head.
No,
you peeped him, Pa repeated gently. You're a latent esper.
Your father cried out on the telepathic level.
If I hadn't been such an ass and so intent on Reich, I'd have realized it long before. You were unconsciously peeping Mary and me all the while you were in my house. She couldn't grasp it.
Do you love me?
Pa shot at her.
I love you, of course, she muttered, but I think you're inventing excuses to...
Who asked you?
Ask me what?
If you loved me.
Why, you just...
She stopped, then tried again.
You said... You...
I didn't say it. Do you understand now? We won't have to settle for anything short of us. Seconds later, it seemed, but it was actually half an hour, they were separated by a violent crash that sounded from the top of the terrace above their heads. They looked up in astonishment. A naked thing appeared on the stone wall, gibbering, screaming, twitching. It toppled over the edge and crashed down through the flower beds until it landed on the lawn, crying and jerking as though a steady stream of voltage was pouring through its nervous system. It was Ben Reich, almost unrecognizable, partway through demolition. Paul swung Barbara to him with her back to Reich. He took her chin in his hand and said, "Are you still my girl?" She nodded. "I don't want you to see this. It isn't dangerous, but it isn't good for you. Will you run back to your pavilion and wait for me, like a good girl?" "All right. Scamper now. Jet." She grabbed his hand, kissed it quickly, and ran across the lawn without once looking back. Powell watched her go, then turned and inspected Reich. When a man is demolished at Kingston Hospital, his entire psyche is destroyed. The series of osmotic injections begins with the topmost strata of cortical synapses and slowly works down, switching off each circuit, extinguishing every memory, destroying every particle of the pattern that has been built up since birth. And as the pattern is erased, each particle discharges its portion of energy, turning the entire body into a shuddering maelstrom of dissociation. But this is not pain. This is not the dread of demolition. The horror lies in the fact that the consciousness is never lost, that as the psyche is wiped out, the mind is aware of its slow, backward death, until at last it too disappears and awaits the rebirth. The mind bids an eternity of farewells. It mourns at an endless funeral. In those blinking, twitching eyes of Ben Reich, Pyle saw the awareness, the pain, the tragic despair. Now, how the hell did he fall down there? Do we have to keep him tied? Dr. Jeames poked his head over the terrace. Oh, hi, pal. That's a friend of yours, remember him? Vividly. Jeames spoke over his shoulder. You go down to the lawn and pick him up. I'll keep an eye on him. He turned to pal. He's a lusty lad. We got great hopes for him. Reich squalled and twitched. How's the treatment coming? Wonderful. He's got the stamina to take anything. We're stepping him up. Ought to be ready for rebirth in a year. I'm waiting for it. We need men like Reich. It would have been a shame to lose him. Lose him? How's that possible? You don't think a little fall like that could... No, I mean something else. 300 or 400 years ago, cops used to catch people like Reich just to kill them. Capital punishment, they called it. You're kidding. Scout's honor. But it doesn't make sense. If a man's got the talent and guts to buck society, he's obviously above average. You want to hold on to him, you straighten him out and turn him into a plus value. Why throw him away? Do that enough and all you got left are the sheep. I don't know. Maybe in those days they wanted sheep. The attendants came trotting across the lawn and picked Reich up. He fought and screamed. They handled him with the deft and gentle Kingston judo while they checked him carefully for breaks and sprains. Then, reassured, they started to lead him away. Just a minute, Pal called. He turned to the stone bench, picked up the mysterious parcel and unwrapped it. It was one of Sucre Issi's most magnificent candy boxes. He carried it to the demolished man and held it out. It's a present for you, Ben. Take it. The creature lowered at Powell and then at the box. At last the clumsy hands came out and took the gift. Why, damn it, I'm just his nursemaid, Pal muttered. We're all of us nursemaids to this crazy world. Is it worth it? Out of the chaos in Reich came an explosive fragment. Powell, peeper. Powell, friend. Powell, friend. It was so sudden, so unexpected, so passionately grateful that Powell was overcome with warmth and tears. He tried to smile, then turned away and wandered across the lawn towards the pavilion and Barbara. Listen, he cried in exultation. Listen, mortals. You must learn what it is. You must learn how it is. You must tear the barriers down. You must tear the veils away. We see the truth you cannot see, that there is nothing in man but love and faith, courage and kindness, generosity and sacrifice. All else is only the barrier of your blindness. One day we'll all be mind to mind and heart to heart. In the endless universe, there has been nothing new, nothing different.
What has appeared exceptional to the minute mind of man has been inevitable to the infinite eye of God. This strange second in a life, that unusual event, those remarkable coincidences of environment, opportunity, and encounter, all of them have been reproduced over and over on the planet of a sun whose galaxy revolves once in 200 million years and has revolved 9 times already. There has been joy. There will be joy again.
That was The Demolished Man by Alfred Bester, read by Jodan Lopp. We hope that you enjoyed this Oasis audiobook. Don't forget that there are many more titles available. If you'd like further information, please write to us for a catalogue or ask your local librarian.